Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Environmentalists and the sugar industry are again clashing over Everglades restoration.
Because they initially were very much for the whole deal. So now, a decade ago, they were all for it. Now they're against it.
Also this week, the National Flood Insurance Program has been extended into next week, but state officials are hoping for a longer-term solution.
So there are areas in the state of Florida and other parts of the United States which are not eligible for flood insurance.
We'll also learn that global climate change is likely to impact Florida more significantly than just about anywhere else. And we'll hear what Florida's soon-to-be former U.S. Senator has been saying and why he keeps saying it. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. A new front in the ongoing battle between Everglades restoration and Florida's sugar industry has opened up. This time, it's over a planned water reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. Environmentalists are suing to block an extension of sugar leases they say could delay construction. We get that story from Lynn Hatter.
Senate Bill 10 was championed by former Senate President Joe Negron, whose southwest Florida home of Stewart has been rocked by years of toxic water discharges from Lake Okeechobee. It was hoped the construction of the reservoir could do two things: clean the water before it's released into smaller rivers downstream, and use that water to help restore the Everglades.
The reservoir will help with reduce destructive discharges to the east and west coast estuaries, and it will allow Lake Okeechobee, it will facilitate Lake Okeechobee water levels being managed in a better way than they are now.
Manly Fuller is president of the Florida Wildlife Federation. The Federation is challenging the South Florida Water Management District regarding its decision to renew leases to sugar companies on land that's slated for the reservoir. The Federation learned of the move a day after it happened in early November. The lease extension is for up to 8 years, and the Federation argues that endangers construction of the reservoir.
Bottom line, we don't want an argument over leasing to slow down moving forward on the reservoir. And we think that that's a potential problem that can happen.
Fuller and the Federation take issue with the short notice that was given to the public, arguing Florida law prohibits last-minute lease deals. New Senate President Bill Galvano told reporters in November he didn't see a problem with it.
I think we watch those issues. The management district was acting in accordance with its authority and based on the timelines that exist. So I did not have an issue with the renewal of the lease.
But Florida's governor-elect, Ron DeSantis, might. DeSantis, along with incoming State Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, are no fans of the sugar industry. Both have blasted it during the course of their campaigns. The Everglades Trust even endorsed DeSantis for governor. Meanwhile, one of the largest agriculture companies, U.S. Sugar, is moving to terminate an option for the state of Florida to purchase 150,000 acres of its land. The Wildlife Federation's Fuller doesn't want to see that happen because he says ongoing Everglades restoration requires more land.
You know, they've changed their opinion on this whole thing because they initially were very much for the whole deal. So now, a decade ago, they were all for it. Now they're against it.
There has always been a lot of noise out there by different parties.
U.S. Sugar argues the land in question was never part of any Everglades restoration effort, and the state law that authorized the reservoir allows for the option to purchase to be terminated. Judy Sanchez is the company's spokeswoman.
There have never been any planned restoration projects for that land, ever. It's all been noise and, I guess, objective objector voices out there.
U.S. sugar produces 10% of the sugar consumed in the country each year. The acreage in question is used to grow winter crops like sweet corn and green beans. It's been actively farmed for nearly 90 years. Sanchez says the idea to use the land for potential Everglades projects was just that, an idea, which the 2008 global downturn largely nixed.
It was a grandiose idea or plan. That was a, maybe it might be nice to have this land in our back pocket when it was proposed, but then the recession happened. It was never brought to fruition, and now there is the language in Senate Bill 10 that says that the district must terminate that option agreement and move forward with the Everglades Agricultural Reservoir.
Still, U.S. Sugar says it continues to support the reservoir project, and it wants to see that completed as soon as possible. So does the Florida Wildlife Federation. There's been no timeline for when and how construction on the project will proceed. When President Donald Trump signed off on it in October, former Senate President Joe Negron said he'd like to see the state break ground in the fall and have it completed within 3 to 5 years. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
As the deadline to renew the National Flood Insurance Program looms over Congress, many are left wondering what they will do if it ends. While the NFIP is the primary source of flood insurance coverage, it is not the only provider, as we hear from Robbie Gaffney.
The National Flood Insurance Program received a last-minute extension and is now set to expire on December 7th. There was a concern that millions of Americans would be forced to search for alternative flood insurance options. Here's Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio.
My hope is that we'll permanently extend it with reforms that allow the program to survive long term, but we have to get this extension done. We're working very hard to make that happen.
Still, if Congress doesn't reauthorize the NFIP by Friday, it will stop selling contracts and will be unable to renew current policies once they reach the end of their term. This means that those who had contracts with the NFIP would have to turn to private flood insurance. Florida's private flood insurance industry has been rapidly growing since 2012 and had a combined 110% increase in policies last year. David Thompson is an instructor at the Florida Association of Insurance Agents. He says prices depend on the property, but private insurance tends to be less expensive.
You'll get replacement cost coverage instead of what we call actual cash value, depreciated value. Replacement cost is new for old, and the NFIP doesn't provide very much of that.
Florida has more than 1.75 million direct and underwritten policies in the federal flood insurance program. That's more than any other state. There are 29 private flood insurance providers in Florida, and more have applied. Thompson says the process to get approval to offer policies can be daunting.
A company can't just jump in the market and start writing this insurance. They've got to have typically their policy coverage forms, and their rates have to be approved by the Florida insurance regulator. And that's a month and month long process.
Historically, flood insurance for the NFIP has been low, but that has changed in more recent years. Still, Florida Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Petronis says NFIP remains popular with consumers.
I think historically, for years, I mean, one, if you consider, you know, how broad of a base of applicants or policyholders we have in the United States, the volume of numbers helps make it possible for it to make it more affordable.
And he worries consumers could take the hit if the federal program goes away.
So there are areas of in the state of Florida and other parts of the United States which are not eligible for flood insurance, and these are areas in a COBRA. So we do have a robust, private sector solution when it comes to flood insurance. But I think when all things being said and done, you know, where, you know, the NFIP is an available option and the coverage that it provides is enough to protect your dwelling, that's going to be the insurance of choice.
While the NFIP's future may currently be uncertain, officials urge homeowners to purchase flood insurance and to review their policies with an insurance agent. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Robbie Gaffney.
This came out of the governor's office late this afternoon following widespread issues with voting in Broward County. Governor Rick Scott today issued an executive order to immediately suspend Supervisor of Elections Brenda Snipes from office for misfeasance, incompetence, and neglect of duty. The authority for the governor to take this action being outlined in Article 4, Section 7 of the Florida Constitution. The governor has appointed Pete Antonacci to serve as Supervisor of Elections in Broward County. Mr. Antonacci will serve for the remainder of the term until a replacement can be chosen by voters in November of 2020. During the 2018 general election, according to numerous media reports, Broward County elections officials missed deadlines, lost ballots, and couldn't report basic information to the public. That resulted in multiple violations of Florida law, according to the governor's office. This follows multiple documented instances throughout Ms. Snipes' term, he added, where Florida laws were broken, including posting election results before polls closed and authorizing the improper destruction of ballots. That, again, coming from the office of Governor Rick Scott late this afternoon. Still to come on Capitol Report, a new federal report on the potential impact of climate change is sparking concern in places like Florida that could feel that impact most acutely.
Many of the southeast cities are particularly vulnerable because of expected impacts to infrastructure in urban areas.
Florida's soon-to-be former U.S. Senator Bill Nelson is making a last-minute push for a few issues he's championed during his tenure in the Senate.
Well, things turned out a little differently than Grace and I had expected. But let me say, I have been very, very blessed.
And as hurricane season comes to an end, we hear from hurricane hunters who braved Category 4 Storm Michael.
I don't know anybody else in the squadron that has seen that. As long as I've been doing it, it was quite impressive to see that.
Two recent studies outlining the progression of climate change have some of Florida's leaders calling for greater legislative action on the subject. Ryan Daly reports those studies were put out by the United Nations and the U.S. government.
Much of the world is grappling with solutions to global changes in climate patterns, and one of the National Climate Assessment's authors says Florida and its surrounding states are particularly susceptible. Kirsten Dow is a professor at the University of South Carolina.
Many of the southeast cities are particularly vulnerable because of expected impacts to infrastructure in urban areas and to health.
Dow contributed to the study's chapter on the Southeast. In a review of her findings hosted by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, she outlined some observable indicators of a changing climate in Floridians' backyard.
Further evidence that climate change is already occurring in looking at the historical change in the length of the freeze-free season. Now, this season has grown by about 10 or 12 days since the 1980s, consistently across the Southeast.
The expanding number of days without a freeze can affect the way farmers grow food.
And this is important because it has implications for agriculture. Many of our key crops, blueberries, peaches, and others, need a certain period of chilling days that they may not get. And it also signals that it's also important for the potential of pests to find new habitat.
And when thinking about climate change, it's not always the days that indicate a shift in patterns.
The really important signal for human health has been that the number of nights above 95 degrees Fahrenheit, those nighttime hours that we depend to cool our houses if we don't have a lot of air conditioning, and to cool the out-of-doors if we're going to plan our work to start early in the morning, have increased substantially.
When it comes to increasing hurricane strength, something Floridians have felt the brunt of in recent years, another of the Southeast chapter's authors says two factors feed into that. Doug Marcy is a coastal hazards specialist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
We think that's due to two factors, and that's what led to the formation and the strength of Irma, which was the warm waters to a greater depth over the hurricane formation areas and areas where they passed through on their way to potentially hit the U.S. Lighter winds in the upper atmosphere as well led to that. So these high-intensity hurricanes are expected to be not necessarily more frequent, but definitely going to be expected to be more intense.
So what's at stake for the Sunshine State? A lot, according to outgoing Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson. He addressed the issue from the Senate floor this week.
Climate change is expected to make South Florida more vulnerable to diseases like the Zika virus. Florida could see more than $346 billion in property value to be lost over the course of this century.
Nelson says the changing climate will make the environment friendlier to harmful algae blooms, something that's constantly been in the news throughout the year. Legislative advocacy group Florida Conservation Voters is reaching out to new leaders in the state capitol.
The reason we wrote the letter and called upon Speaker Oliva and President Galvano to actually set up a select committee on climate change is because our state's already feeling these impacts. And when it comes to policies to address those impacts, we're kind of at the bottom of the pile compared to a lot of other states and countries.
That's the group's director, Aliki Moncrief. She says the state's new commissioner of agriculture, Nikki Freed, stands to make a big impact. Moncrief says Freed can take the lead on things like protecting lands, providing urban forestry grants to communities, and heading up the state office of energy.
She's going to be looking at these issues with fresh eyes, and she's not beholden to some of the special interests I think that have captivated cabinet positions before.
While the Southeast may be more vulnerable to a changing climate, Professor Kirsten Dow says there are some positives on the horizon.
While those are concerns, there's also opportunities because while we're in the fastest, many of the Southeast cities are among the fastest growing in the country, that growth is an opportunity to do more effective design and improve our urban design and reduce the reduce greenhouse gas emissions to prevent these further negative impacts of climate change.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
As outgoing U.S. Senator Bill Nelson prepares to leave office, he's making a final push for a few of his priority issues. Regan McCarthy reports Nelson, unseated by Florida Republican Governor Rick Scott, is leaving the Senate.
The outgoing Florida Democrat says trickle-down economics aren't working.
We need to do more to lift up those at the bottom and help them help themselves.
Nelson says instead of tax breaks for big corporations, he'd like to see more support for local and small business owners.
They're more likely to keep profits in the community, creating a more sustainable loop of economic activity, and that's what I want to recommend, that this Senate and future Senates do.
Nelson introduced a bill earlier this year that would give tax breaks to businesses that renovate and move into vacant buildings. He says he'd like to see similar legislation come from the new members of the body. Nelson talked about the issue in one of a series of what he calls concluding speeches he's making on the Senate floor in the remaining days of his term.
To comment on various matters that I have had the privilege of working in. And I want to say that with regard to the election, well, things turned out a little differently than Grace and I had expected. But let me say, I have been very, very blessed. And that's because I've had the privilege of serving the people of Florida and our country for most of my life.
In addition to talking about economic changes he'd like to see, Nelson highlighted something he hopes won't change, a requirement in the Affordable Care Act that companies offer health coverage to those with pre-existing conditions.
When the ACA passed, it stated that an insurance company cannot deny health insurance coverage because a person had a pre-existing condition. In other words, that means that you cannot be denied health coverage because you have something like asthma or cancer or heart trouble or diabetes or ALS or, in some cases, even a rash.
Nelson says the Affordable Care Act has helped people who otherwise would not be able to get health coverage. He says it's important to keep it in place, but admits it's far from perfect.
There's a lot of work to be done to bring down the cost of health care, to make insurance more affordable, and increase coverage for people who still don't have it. But in the meantime, the Trump administration is doing everything in its power to undermine and undo the existing law that has helped so many so much.
Nelson points to President Donald Trump's push to repeal the Affordable Care Act and moves his administration has made that have led to a decrease in enrollment, including cutting the time for people to get signed up. Another issue Nelson has addressed through his concluding speeches is global warming and the environment. He says many of the dangers faced by Floridians, from stronger hurricanes to the Zika virus, are being prompted by global warming. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
An appeals court today blocked a lawsuit aimed at requiring Governor Rick Scott to disclose more information about his financial assets, saying such issues should be handled by the Florida Commission on Ethics. Scott, the wealthiest governor in state history, took the issue to the First District Court of Appeal after a Leon County Circuit judge refused to dismiss a lawsuit filed by Tallahassee attorney Don Hinkle. The case centered in part on whether Scott should have provided more information about assets in a blind trust when filing state financial disclosure forms. A three-judge panel of the appeals court granted what is known as a writ of prohibition, barring the circuit judge from taking any further action in the case. The five-page ruling agreed with Scott's argument that only the Commission on Ethics has constitutional authority to investigate Mr. Hinkle's complaint. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, today is the last day of hurricane season. Florida suffered through another powerful storm this year as Hurricane Michael threatened the panhandle. The Florida Center for Investigative Reporting's Tristan Corton was with the Air Force Reserve on a flight to gather historic information to help us better understand such big storms.
Wednesday morning, October 10th. The 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron of the U.S. Air Force Reserve is getting ready to fly a C-130 Hurricane Hunter into Hurricane Michael. Lieutenant Colonel Sean Cross gives a briefing.
So, hey guys, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Sean Cross. I'm an aircraft commander today for this flight.
This will be the 53rd's ninth and final mission into Michael, a massive Category 4 hurricane barreling towards the Florida Panhandle.
Historic flight, obviously. You know, it's a strong, powerful hurricane that's making landfall on the Florida Gulf Coast.
The mission is to launch cardboard tubes containing data-gathering instruments into the storm. The tubes are called dropsondes. They get loaded into metal chutes and then shot out of the plane's belly. The data from the dropsondes is transmitted back to the National Hurricane Center in Miami in real time.
Bottom line, we are saving lives.
This is where the information used in the forecast and advisories comes from. Wind speed and direction, barometric pressure, temperature, the dew point, or how much moisture the storm is holding. These missions are more vital today because of the warming climate. Trapped greenhouse gases are heating the oceans. When Michael formed, the temperature in the Gulf of Mexico was about 84 degrees, roughly 3 to 4 degrees warmer than the October average. The warmer the water, the faster and stronger storms can grow. Warm water is hurricane fuel. Hurricane Michael powered up quickly and continued intensifying as it approached the shore. That's why it caused so much destruction. The data from this flight will help scientists figure out the mechanics of how that happened, because usually hurricanes weaken as they get closer to shore. The dry air from land evaporates moisture, robbing energy from the storm. As the plane approaches Michael's eye, nothing is visible outside the cockpit windshield. Dense gray clouds blot out the sky. There's no way to tell up or down. Suddenly, the nose of the plane breaks through into bright sunshine and blue sky. The hurricane's eye. Surrounding the plane, there's a vertical wall of clouds miles high.
The inside of Hurricane Michael, if you can picture this in your mind, is a giant steel barrel, 18-mile diameter, and the eye wall was straight vertical.
And the C-130's crew, including Lieutenant Colonel Byron Hudges, are in awe.
After doing this for almost 20 years, I've probably seen this sort of presentation maybe four or five times. I mean, it shows the strength of what's
As the plane going exits on the through the opposite eye wall, the loadmaster launches one of the tubes for gathering data. Lieutenant Colonel Cross takes a break from the controls and walks to the back of the aircraft.
So we just exited out of Hurricane Michael for our first pass today. It's a very, very powerful storm with a low pressure. It's very deep. It's 929.
The plane penetrates the eye four times during the mission. The last time recorded a barometric pressure of 919 millibars, one of the lowest ever recorded for a hurricane making landfall in the U.S. The lower the pressure, the stronger the storm. This was when the plane hit a pocket of turbulence and dropped 1,000 or 2,000 feet. Passengers flew up off their seats 6 inches. Bags and containers went up at least a foot. Major Dave Gentile had the controls at the time. He later explained what happened.
Well, that just basically the section that we were going into was a really rough patch of turbulence. The autopilot kicked off and you basically just have to hand fly it. It gets too rough for the autopilot to handle it, and that's, I guess, what they pay us for.
The plane stabilized after flying back into the eye, and that's when, looking straight down, the crew could see waves crashing into the shore. The exact moment of landfall. Back on base, Lieutenant Colonel Sean Cross said this was a first.
Basically unprecedented. I don't know anybody else in the squadron that has seen that. As long as I've been doing it, it was quite impressive to see that.
Scientists now had data from the exact moment Hurricane Michael crashed onto the coast. Normally, Hurricane Hunter missions end before the storm reaches shore. It was a mission as important as it was rough.
I'm going to have a beer, too. That was a long day. It was only a 5.5-hour flight, but it was one that we won't forget.
And when it comes to hurricanes, what we know may be changing. I'm Tristram Corton in Miami.
Tristram Corton is author of Into the Storm. This story was a partnership between WLRN and the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Robbie Gaffney and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.